I'm Iris McAlpin, and you're listening to Pure Curiosity, an exploration of the human experience and what it takes to be mentally healthy in our modern world. All right, Hayden, thank you so much for being here this morning. I'm excited to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to this.
So to begin, would you mind telling us just a little bit about yourself and your background and what you're passionate about?
Yeah. So I like to introduce myself as being a compassion warrior, sort of taking something from Buddhist practices. And, you know, essentially that I'm trying to awaken not just from my own suffering for myself, but also for everyone, you know, sort of this unbiased view of helping us all do better in the ways in which we care for ourselves and care for others. So, but essentially the way that I do that in the world is I've been a clinical social worker for 8 years, is when I started my graduate school process. And in doing that work, I fell in love with sort of providing care as well as advocacy for vulnerable populations, folks that are suffering from homelessness, mental illnesses, folks that were in the hospital and needing to be discharged. So I have a kind of a wide breadth of sort of different experiences. Primarily, though, I think of myself as a mental health clinician for sure. I love the art and the practice of psychotherapy, and I did that for a few years working with veterans and then also focusing primarily on people of color and LGBTQ identified folks and the folks that live at that intersection. So in doing that work in the community and in different communities, psychotherapy communities, one of the things I started noticing is our inability to sit with, metabolize, and stay grounded and regulated in talking about race and racism and all other forms of identity. So that was one of the things that propelled me into pursuing my PhD. So I'm currently a PhD student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I am doing research in those areas to talk about sort of mental health equity and what that looks like.
Thank you for doing that. Wow, that is so important. And I'm always curious to hear, how did you find yourself in social work? What was the motivating force for you to choose that path?
Yeah, so before I went to school for social work, my undergrad is actually in vocal performance. In high school, I loved being in musicals. I loved chorus. Those are very protective kind of pieces for me as I was sort of discovering my Black gay identity, and that was really like a cocoon to keep myself safe. The arts definitely did that for me. And so like a lot of high school students, the thing that I was good at was the thing I was like, well, I'm going to study that. So I went to a school here in North Carolina to study vocal performance. And it was hard. It was really difficult at times. Some of my first kind of experiences where I really could recognize that shame was happening for me, kind of that old kind of conservatory way of practicing the arts. And as graduation was happening and the Great Recession was occurring, I said to myself, Hayden, do you want to get a master's in this? And I said, you know, I don't think that's going to be the most viable option for me. I'm not sure that's really what I want to do. Also, I was having some physical issues with my vocal folds themselves. One was kind of stiff. I also had horrible acid reflux, as well as a lot of tension that I was dealing with and a lot of chronic allergy issues. So I just knew that that wasn't going to be my path. So I started working in retail partner sales for telecommunication companies selling cell phones and then later selling cable and internet. And I was working inside of retail big box stores. And I remember selling cable to this lovely woman. And she asked me as I was trying to sell her a package, she says, well, Hayden, does this package come with C-SPAN 3? And I said, who the heck watches C-SPAN 3? And she said, well, I do. I'm a political science professor. And I was like, okay. And she says, well, Hayden, let me ask you this. She said, do you want to go back to school? And I'm like, absolutely. I definitely want to go back to school. I'm thinking about getting an MBA. And she says, you don't want an MBA. I'm like, but why not? You know, come to find out, she was a music education major. And she said, well, I'll tell you why. She said, well, let me ask you this first. She says, what is it about your job do you love? And I was like, well, I really love connecting with people, seeing how my products can fit into their lives and fit their needs. She says, what about your job don't you like? I said, the numbers. I mean, they feel really heavy on me. I feel like I'm selling people stuff that they really can't afford, but yet that is my agenda. That's what I'm being pushed to do. And she says, okay. She says, well, that's why you need to look at an MPA, a Master's of Public Administration. And I was like, what the heck is that? She says, well, public administrators work in nonprofits. They work in local government. Instead of thinking about stockholders, they're thinking about key stakeholders. And I said, huh. She says, sounds like it would be a closer line to your values. And I was like, interesting. So then I went back home because I was really feeling miserable in my job. I mean, that's the honest truth. I know it wasn't for me. And yet I was very grateful. I was making a lot of money for someone at that age in their 20s. And so I was seeing a lot of programs, MPA programs, that also had a joint master's of social work. And I'm an extremely ambitious person. So I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll think about doing a dual master's. And I really had no understanding as to what a social worker is. You know, I probably had a lot of the same myths of, you know, there's someone that goes and they take people's children away and all these kind of ideas that really are horrendous. And at the same time, my best friend was in a 3-year social work program, and I still had no understanding of a social work. So I got into a program and for Master's of Social Work and a Master's of Public Administration, and I was determined to try to do both. Even though both program directors are like, just do one master's and get a PhD in the other. I was taking the MPA classes and I was like, you know, this is kind of interesting. Government ordinances, like, yeah. But then I was going to social work classes and my whole body just lit up. I felt seen. I felt a sense of belonging. I said, wow, you mean I can be Black and gay in this space and it is an asset to me? And after that, I was turned on.
That's amazing. Well, speaking of that, I know we wanted to talk about it, your article in Medium. And so the title of the article is An Invitation to White Therapists. And because you just said, you know, that it was okay for you to be Black and gay in that space, I am interested in your experiences working with other white therapists and some of the challenges that has brought. Because I know there are a lot of mental health professionals who listen to this podcast. And so, you know, I highly encourage reading the article, which I will link in the episode. But I'm wondering, too, if you've had some thoughts since you've written this, and just I'm interested also in the response that you received.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts still. I have worked with the various different mental health professions, psychiatrists, counselors, LMFTs, LPCs, element, you know, whatever language you want to put to it, right? In this discipline, in this art. And I've noticed an inability to sit and stay grounded. You know, just I'm speaking in generalizations. I recognize that with talking about race. I was working in a mental health setting in which we had a retreat with a lot of different disciplines were there. And this presenter, as she started talking about race, and she was a white woman, I could see the whole entire room shift. The energy shifted. We got very tribal, very limbic, activated. And it was like folks had regressed to the age of, I don't even know, just very young.
Yeah.
And I recognize that these are people that can sit and hold sexual trauma and other kinds of abuses and harms. But for whatever reason, when race was brought up in the room, there was inability to hear and see each other. And I thought, oh my goodness, if this is happening amongst colleagues, and some of these people had been practicing longer than I've been alive, what on earth is happening in session or not happening in session?
Right. Yeah, that's key. Because I think when things are stepped over in session, that can be re-traumatizing.
Right. Absolutely re-traumatizing and not seeing what's really happening. I think, and this is an idea I have, and I'd be curious to hear what you say about this, is that if white clinicians were really to see that their clients of color come with these discriminations that are constantly happening and that are historically driven, and there's a legacy from what their family has experienced, that means they would have to see in their own whiteness.
Yes.
That means that they would have to see in their own privileges that they did not earn.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge part of it. And it is confronting for a lot of people. You know, initially, privilege was confronting for me as well, because I felt like I had an eating disorder and I had all these things happen to me. So, you know, what privileges did I have? Which is now I recognize ridiculous. But, you know, I think for a lot of people, having to acknowledge the ways that they've achieved success that they didn't earn is a tough pill to swallow. And I still think it's important. I mean, I recognize that, you know, a lot of the success that I've had is because of my appearance and, you know, my socioeconomic status that I was raised in. And, you know, that's something that's important for me to acknowledge. And I can't just say like, oh yeah, do what I did and you'll have the results that I have to everyone. That's not real life.
Right. Yes. One of the things that, as you were talking, that we really have to look at the way that we're socialized and the fact that us thinking in terms of color blindness keeps perpetuating the racial hierarchy as to what it yes. is. And I fear that in our American drive for this idea of achievement or success, that we leave other people behind. And I think there's something, I don't have a better word for this, that's extremely insidious about this in the mental health, and I would also include coaching as well, spaces,
sure.
is that we folks go in thinking that they want to make the world better and they want to be good, great people without really taking stock as to the harms and the discriminations that one is doing in the quest of being a good person and doing the right thing.
It's so true. And I think some of that, there's like this weird knee-jerk reaction that I think happens where it's like, okay, if I'm going to be a good person, that means I can't be racist. And racism happens because there are people of different backgrounds and skin colors. And so I'm just going to not, it's almost like being an ostrich, putting your head in the sand. It's like, okay, I'm just not going to see the color and then I can't be racist. I think it's almost this like childlike mentality. It's sort of like magical thinking almost. And, you know, sure, in an ideal world, that would be nice if we could all just, you know, see each other as human. But there's also so much richness in seeing our differences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
That gets missed in that. And I think, you know, my one of my many hopes for this time period is that as people learn to see color and appreciate cultural differences, that will be a massive healing step for our society.
Right. I mean, I remain hopeful and yet kind of assured that this is a generations long process. This
yeah.
is centuries to undo this.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And, you know, I sort of encourage my white colleagues to recognize that. There's urgency to solve these ills, and yet it's not going to happen in one generation or one decade. And so we can either look at that as a way to take a little bit of that pressure off when we feel overwhelmed about solving racial injustice, just a tiny bit. I mean, and still yet, the other side, you're still called to show up. This is not a pass to just, you know, like you said, be the ostrich and put your head down in the sand. And I think if we still recognize this is going to take a long time, it's far more sustainable that way.
I think that's right. I think there are some people that are like reading every single book, just like staying up all night, like cramming, like it's for an exam or something like that. And it's like, no, like slow your roll. It's, you gotta like digest this. You've gotta like take it in over time and let it
Girl,
sit and simmer.
If you could see my face, I am shaking my head. Like it's, no, it's, I'm sorry. It's not going to be solved by reading White Fragility. It's just right. not. You know, and you and if we're going to think in the lens of trauma, we have to be intentional with our nervous system. Stay Absolutely. In that pocket, right? To keep kind of titrating a little bit more and recognize that there might be times to rest. And that rest, it gives us the space to go back forth.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you. So true. There was something else about that I wanted to ask you. Well, yeah, I think there were a few things, but one in particular, because you're doing research on this, I am interested in your take on why race in particular and identity politics are things that are, you know, as you mentioned, these therapists who've been in practice for longer than you had been alive were bristling at this topic. And since this is something that, you know, you're studying deeply, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on why this is so triggering for people.
I think so. There's several reasons. And I think one of the reasons is we're taught not to name it. And, you know, if we don't name it, we can't tame it, right? I come up with that.
I love
Dan
it.
Singleton. But if we don't name it, we can't tame it. And so it hasn't been infused in the curriculums in which we practice. Furthermore, if we think about the stat that 70% of white people do not have one friend of color.
Wow. That's insane.
And yet it makes sense when we look at it from a really big systemic point of view. Segregation is still alive and real. We don't even worship the one place where people should literally feel the closest in their humanity and their sacredness and divinity to one another is church. It's church, spiritual communities, a sangha, a friends meeting, a mosque. That is the place in my mind and in my spirit and my being where we should feel the most togetherness. And yet it can be the most segregated hour. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X talked about the most segregated hour in America is 11 a.m. on a Sunday.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, so I grew up in Texas, and that's exactly what I observed. You know, you go to the Baptist church in one neighborhood, it's completely white. You go to the Baptist church in the other neighborhood, and it's completely black. And there was almost no, maybe even no mixing whatsoever.
Yeah. And the thing that's coming, the idea that's coming to my mind right now is this, we have to remember this is also about power. And that's something that I don't think we necessarily get really comfortable in sort of thinking about. This mm-hmm. is about political power and slicing this. And you talk a lot about abundance mindset versus scarcity mindset. It plays into that. So if we don't name it, that means we don't have to do anything about it. We can put our heads down in the sand. And the community of psychotherapists are also a part of that. If you think about it, Iris, so many of the schools of therapy, their founders are white men. The voices that get heralded are white men. Even the women, the white women who have brought different practices sort of into the zeitgeist, they don't even get named as often. I would say the biggest figure right now is probably Marsha Linehan's work, right?
Tell me more about her. We haven't learned her in my graduate program yet.
Yeah. So Marsha Linehan is someone who herself was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And she is the founder and the creator of
dialectical
behavioral therapy, right?
It's funny. I know that, and I don't know her name, so that kind of proves your point.
Right, but you know Aaron Beck's name.
Yeah, I do. That is
You
exactly
know, a lot
it.
of folks, I mean, do you know about Virginia Sartier?
Yes, I do. Yeah, she's
Yeah.
amazing.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is we need to herald other voices, and our gold standard, and I'm putting that in quotes, treatment modalities often herald the same people, and it says this is the way that you should be doing practice. And let's just discount the fact that we are using really small samples of African Americans, Latinx Americans, Asian Americans, of people who might identify as being queer, trans folks, gay people. Let's just ignore that. Let's ignore the fact that there are socioeconomic reasons why certain clients may not be able to tolerate some of these treatments, and they quote unquote dropped out.
Yes. So you put that in your Medium article, and this tendency to just say like, oh, they just discontinued therapy, or they weren't a good fit for me, seems to be something that therapists can kind of hide behind in a
Oh,
way.
absolutely. Especially in a private practice setting. You know, I am thankful that I've worked in an agency, a private agency, as well as sort of a big government, space where I can't necessarily pick and choose my clients.
Right.
And to me, there is something, so there's pros and cons to both approaches. When you have to take a client because they're next on the list, you end up being sort of exposed to seeing everyone and not coming with your preconceived notions and biases to tell you, oh, I can't work with that person or I can't work with this person. But when you work in private practice, I mean, we don't even really have good data to necessarily know how many people are saying, I don't want to work with that person because they have that funny sounding name. So there's no eyes on private practice clinicians, are there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't think there's any mandatory reporting of the demographic information of your clients. So there's no way for us to really track that.
No, but yet when we think about sort of government and Medicaid dollars, where people are committing to working with folks of all different socioeconomic statuses, people do get, in my mind, probably the care that they need in those settings that is very different than people that are in sort of who have insurance. So there's lots of layers to this. I can sense the kind of a little bit of the overwhelm of it, right?
Well, yeah, it's just such a complex issue. It's like, where do we start? I mean, I'm really, really, really just infinitely grateful that my graduate program is centered on multicultural counseling, and this is basically what we're studying is, how to not be culturally misattuned to your client and when to ask questions and when to ask, colleagues for support and to not pretend like you have all the answers. So I think that's part of it too. Therapists maybe historically have been trained like, you're supposed to know everything, or there's maybe that's just sort of embedded in the culture. And so if they're presented with a client where, they don't know about their cultural attitudes and beliefs and background, and they don't feel that their expertise holds up, that's humbling, and for some people that may be too humbling. They may not be
Right.
able to hold that and sit with the discomfort of that. And I think, part of, I'm so grateful to my dad. I think he really instilled this in me, just this like intense curiosity. I mean, the name of my podcast is Pure Curiosity. I think that kind of is my saving grace with almost everything, because if you're curious, then it's really all about learning, and there's no ego in that. It's just like, wow, okay, like I want to learn more about this. Like maybe I'm wrong. I like being wrong because that means I'm
Right.
learning.
I love that.
It's just a different orientation toward the world, and I am just 0% invested in being right because of that. And I think that's
Amen.
a challenge for a lot of people.
I absolutely agree with you. I think the perfectionism that comes from white
Yeah.
supremacist culture can be such a straitjacket to our bodies, our minds, our spirits. I've even my own experience in being this PhD program. When I started, And I'd been working so long as a clinician, and I felt a lot of competence around that. And then being a student again, learning different methods of research in statistical software. And I felt myself feel like a child again and feel unguarded. And that was a reminder to lean into the vulnerability that goes along with the curiosity and moving forward. That is part of the process.
Yeah. And I am interested to hear you expand a little bit more on white supremacy culture and perfectionism, if you're willing to go there. I think that's something that as soon as I read that, that just immediately landed. It was like, yep, that makes sense to me. But I think a lot of people don't know about that or haven't been exposed to that idea.
Yeah, I think, so one thing, I think being, lately I've been thinking, I'm so glad in some respects of being a Black gay man. You want to know why, Iris?
I do.
It doesn't matter what I do. I will never be perfect in the standards of what it means to be a perfect American and be a perfect human being. And with that, there have been ways in my own internalized racism and oppression to try to get out of that. I have overly compensated. I've tried to get everything right. Even when I was a singer, I was so concerned about every tone that would come out of my mouth, the way I would hold my body, the way I look, just so driven to be this ideal Instagram model and to be this ideal academic, this ideal clinician in just, but the culture situates us in a way that that is quote unquote attainable when in fact it's not. And the more that I lean into my gayness, into my Blackness, into all that I am, the more that I recognize how countercultural that is because I can never be perfect to this culture.
There's a lot to unpack with that because I think, yeah, there's something about like proximity to this like idealized or like what our culture deems as quote unquote perfect, which I think is ridiculous, but it exists. There's these cultural ideals like for women of thinness, of, you know, of whiteness. And it's like the closer you get, the more crazy making it gets in a way. It's like this carrot that can never be reached.
And so, we're all in that trap.
Yeah.
I mean, I've sat with plenty of a white man who they too are trapped in the culture that says that there's any one way that they should be. And I've seen it. I've noticed it. Is so deeply wounding these ideal images. And yet I recognize it's one of the things that keeps, you know, the way that we do capitalism in its current form, it keeps that maintained. You know, one of the things I've been thinking a lot more about recently, and I didn't do this a few years ago, was to think about how this creates a power structure of dominance and oppression.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot lately too, and this sort of idea of, you know, we hear a lot about grind culture and how that is really toxic. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. I don't think it's sort of like, no matter how much you're doing, no matter how busy you are, it's not enough. You should be doing more. You should be making more. You should be, it's this like have it all, do it all, be it all kind of American dream. And, you know, I guess that sounds nice in some way, you know, this idea that we can have it all, do it all, be it all, but that places a tremendous amount of pressure. And I think a lot of people internalize that pressure and end up beating themselves up, end up shaming themselves and guilting themselves for not, you know, having their life be as perfect as what they're seeing other people's, you know, their projected lives on social media. And it just ends up getting really unhealthy.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the ways I see this reflected in psychotherapy is our drive for change too quickly, our drive for goals too quickly, not being attuned to that. And I know times where I've fallen into traps with that. With generally when I've had clients sort of drop out of treatment, it's because I have not, I've sort of pushed for too much too soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's so right. Well, it's instant gratification culture too. You know, it's like I want to push a button on my phone and have it in 24 hours or less. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we can go so much further with acceptance. Yeah. You know, and I think if I could say anything to my white colleagues is to learn to accept all parts of your clients of color. Even the parts that it might be difficult for you to accept, you need to learn to love that because they need help in loving that themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that I've been thinking a lot recently is there's this, sort of this other idea in therapy that you don't talk about something that your client's not mentioning. Even though we know that people will mention they'll mention their own dogs, they'll mention things that are like way on the outside and really not that important. So, oh, I'm not going to talk about race in session because they haven't brought it up. And it's kind of like, that's not, you know, let's not get so caught up in one or the other. You need to learn to accept your client's blackness. And if you can't, you need to be, you know, to use pure curiosity, to use yours and your dad's words, you need to get curious about that. What does that mean for you that you can accept that?
Yeah, that is such a beautiful inquiry. You know, I think something that I love about the modality that I practice and that I'm trained in is there's so much emphasis on countertransference and like what's coming up for you in the session and why is that coming up for you and processing that and being curious about that. And I think if we're not doing that, we do unconsciously act out on our clients. And it's not that we're not well-intentioned, but it's if you haven't named it, you can't tame it thing. You know, if you're not really looking at your own reactions or your own hesitations, I think that's what it is a lot of time. It's like this hesitation to like bring up something that might be complex. And if we're not ready to sit in the mess of that, or we're not ready to possibly make a misstep or have some kind of conversation that requires repair or apology,
right?
You know, that's not good for our clients. We need to be able to model those like healthy repairing conversations and to not be reactive and all of these things. And it's unfortunate that that's not a bigger part of, and I'm sure there are, you know, other modalities that emphasize that as well, but it seems like that's somewhat rare that countertransference is given a huge amount of emphasis.
I could talk about that for quite some time. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it kind of goes back to this culture of being the expert.
Yeah.
And, you know, the therapist doesn't have flaws themselves. You know, let me get this manualized treatment that has all the answers,
right?
You know, trying to control for everything. And as someone that's in the research world, I think the way that we've researched psychotherapy in the past 20 years, I think has lended itself to there being a right answer and there being a right way of doing things. And that does not include the therapist's stuff of the therapist understanding their own stuff in and out of session.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting. If you read a lot of clinical books, you'll hear stories, you know, case studies of clients who come in that have suffered significant narcissistic abuse, and then it'll be mentioned like, oh yeah, her father was a psychologist, and you're like, oh crap. You know, there's so many stories of these like prominent psychologists and psychiatrists who just had so much stuff that they hadn't examined, and yet they're in therapy sessions telling people, you know, this is what you should be doing, and this is what's healthy, and this is what's not healthy. And I just find that troubling. I really hope that's changing. I feel like it probably is, but historically.
I bet it is changing. You know, one of the things that I love being part of this millennial generation is that I feel like therapy is being democratized a little bit more. I think the consumer of therapy, and I'm using that word intentionally, is more equipped to understand it. I mean, people talk about it. They talk about it with their friends. Do I think there are some misleading ideas out there about what therapy is and isn't? Yeah, I definitely think so. And yet I do recognize that there is, it's cool to be in therapy right now, and it's cool to be a therapist. There's a reason why we have Instagram followings.
For sure. Yeah. And that gives me a lot of hope. And, you know, in the program that I'm running right now, you know, there's a lot of young people that are so excited to be, you know, talking about self-sabotage and complex trauma, and they know what that is. And that's, to me, very hopeful that, you know, the younger generation is really seeking out healing in a way that previous generations haven't. I think we have done some very good work in terms of breaking down stigma, and people are hungry for it. And that, I mean, that for me feels very optimistic.
Yes, very welcome. And I think, to me, that's a charge to those in the therapy community and folks in the coaching community as well, that we can't take our work lightly. We don't have to be serious about it. And yet we shouldn't take it lightly. Like, we really are influencing. And I think I said that at the end of an invitation.
Yeah.
We are influencing culture right now. I think people trust their therapist, especially if they've been working with them a lot while, and their coach, more than they trust the government and religious institutions and their schools. I mean, especially right now in the time of COVID, that's not, and I, you know, I think we should show up and be able to make mistakes, but like, we are an extremely powerful community of people, and I want us to own that power.
Yeah, I am fully with you on that. Yeah, something that that I'm curious just to hear from people in the field right now is, how is COVID impacting the people that you're working with? What kinds of patterns are you seeing with people at the moment?
So I actually am not practicing right now.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And the reason is because being a PhD student, talk about grind culture, being a PhD student and trying to practice at the same time. And I wanted to make an intentional shift towards doing more teaching, lecturing, writing, to doing more of that work. But it's been a few weeks since I saw ended with my last patient or client, whatever language you want to use, y'all. Because you look, that's its own debate unto itself. Client, patient, client, patient. And I'm like, child, I'm just trying to help you. But I would notice that, like, folks would have a really good week, a really bad week, a really good week, being with them as they try to orient to the lack of uncertainty that's happening and occurring, especially those who have young kids. I mean, what a trying time when they don't necessarily have access to a community of other caregivers for their children and for those that can sort of pour back into them. So that is definitely something that I had started to notice was developing as a pattern. And I think how that impacts family systems and relationships between people, on top of Black Lives Matter. So there was sort of this existential questioning, and I would notice there'd be weeks of folks being okay with that questioning to weeks of, oh my gosh, doom and gloom.
Yeah, that sounds right. I'm seeing similar patterns. And, you know, there's a part of me, and I want to be careful as I say this, because I don't, like, this isn't a situation I would wish on anyone. And it is, you know, particularly for, like you said, people with small children, people of color, like, this is a very trying time. And at the same time, I think we've kind of been in a trance as a culture, I think, for a while, not really looking at all, well, I want to couch this as well, that there are plenty of people who've been well aware of how broken our systems are, but I think there's, like, an awakening to how much isn't working and how much this sort of myth of the American dream is a myth, and this kind of like breaking down of like who we are outside of culture. And it's like, it's very, it gets slippery, it gets existential very, very quickly. But it's like, okay, if all of these things I've thought about my culture aren't true, and if these things that I've thought about myself aren't true, and I'm sort of stripped of my usual routine, like, who am I? And so I think situations like this start to get people to ask these bigger questions that maybe they've never asked before. And there's something about that that I think, you know, it has potential to go a variety of different ways. But I think if people are willing to sit with the discomfort of that, because it is quite uncomfortable, there's something possible. There's like a deeper spiritual truth that becomes, I don't even know what the right word is, but it's, well, like, does that make sense? This is kind of murky territory.
No. I mean, it makes all the sense to me. Iris, yeah. There is no ground.
Exactly. Thank you.
And there never, ever, ever was. There never any was. Ground.
Yeah.
I remember going into my therapist's office around the last presidential election, and I was like, oh my gosh, Joe, it's like there's no ground. He said, Hayden, there is no ground. And as soon as he said that, I sunk deeper down into the couch. This idea that we know what's going to happen in the next moment is a lie.
Yeah.
It was never true. We don't know who we are. We are constantly in flux. We don't know these systems. We didn't want to look at things clearly. I will say, and I think this is important caveat, those who had privilege that were more steeped in it are having the hardest time right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, it's been interesting to watch. You know, I grew up, you know, at a school with a lot of very, very affluent people, and sort of not all of them, but watching some of them really kind of come apart during this time period, because they've never really had to think about anything. You know, they've never had to question anything because all the structures were working perfectly in their favor. And so I do have a lot of compassion for them because this is not something they're practiced at sitting with. But yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, we're sort of balancing on the head of a pin over an infinite abyss all the time. Well, it's like...
And I think what you're getting to and what you kind of said is that, like, this is an opening and an opportunity for collective and individual liberation.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to be willing to sit in the pocket of that discomfort and the pocket of that groundlessness.
Yeah, there's something about sitting in that. It's free fall is what it is. And that's exhilarating. It's scary. And then there's like... Yeah, as you said, there's like a freedom that comes with that. And so that's very exciting for me right now.
Iris, can I jump in?
Yeah, please.
I would not have written an invitation to white therapists had I not been in the free fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had nothing else to lose. I was envisioning, in particularly Black men and Black women, and for my Black trans siblings as well, and gender nonconforming folks, being in session with a white therapist who were going to say nothing about Breonna Taylor, who were going to say nothing about George Floyd, who were going to say nothing about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 from the economic disparities, from the legal disparities, from the health disparities. In session, but we're going to be busy trying to fill out a form about mindfulness. We'll be busy trying to do some sort of somatic exercise related to, I don't know, getting in touch with one's skin, but not giving the context of what is happening for Black people in this country right now, if the free fall had not been happening for me. So yes, it is an opportunity.
Yeah, gosh, when you say that, like you're describing that scenario, and I know that's what a lot of people are experiencing in therapy, and it just makes me wonder where the humanity went. It's like...
The medical model.
Yeah, that, I think you nailed it. Yeah, it's like, if that was your friend, if that was somebody that you knew, you would say like, hey, like, how are you doing? You know, if they came over to your house, you would ask, like, how are you doing with what's happening? And for therapists to not go there, just, yeah, it's exactly that. It's like, okay, I have this manual and I have these steps that I'm supposed to take you through, and this is the correct way, quote unquote, to proceed. And so I'm just going to follow this. And I mean, that's how I always felt in therapy, you know, that I was just sort of getting pushed through this.
Well, and but what does it say? And this is going to be really controversial, Iris, when in particularly, and you check me on this, I'm taking a risk and being really vulnerable.
Great.
When white women in particular, who are the majority of therapists in this country, are taught to fear Black people and Black men in particular, what does it say when they're sitting across in session? How do you welcome in something that you are been taught to be fearful of?
Yeah, that is a deep question, because I think there's a million answers to that. There's as many answers as there are people in that situation. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, because that's not an experience I've ever had, but I can imagine there are women having that experience. And, you know, how can we create an open dialogue for that in a way that isn't harmful to the client? And I'm not sure what the answer is for that. But I think what can be harmful is, you know, if someone's sitting there and having that experience and not naming it and the other person feels it, that's seems almost worse to me, because then it's like this elephant in the room that's not getting talked about. And there's like shame that gets tangled into that as well. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on that. But I feel like transparency is so helpful.
It is, you know, and I've been challenged from some Black colleagues in particular that kind of say, you know, if it's going to be re-traumatizing for some clients, don't bring it up. And I don't know, I struggle with that.
Yeah.
Because we talk about other things that could be re-traumatizing for people. So why should race be not mentioned? You know, I don't know. Again, I think you kind of talked about attunement is really important.
Yeah.
Understanding that not all of your Black clients are going to respond the same way.
For sure, yeah.
And the timing of it has to be really important, and how you do it. And you're not going to get it all right all the time.
For sure. Yeah, I guess my thinking is like, people are so intuitive. Maybe they don't relate to themselves as being intuitive, but we pick up on so much.
I'm shaking my head right now.
Yeah. And so it's like, if you're sitting with something as a therapist or coach, your client maybe wouldn't even have the words to name it, but they're feeling something's off, you know? And so I'm a big fan of laying things out on the table in a, you know, in a skillful way, in a like well thought out way, and in a way that considers their experience over yours, but also, you know, not trying to pretend. I think pretending can be damaging.
I think absolutely, but I think we have a really, people misunderstand what self-disclosure means. You know, self-disclosure that's not relevant in terms of talking about one's spouse, one's kids, one's dog.
Right.
That's not that. But talking about what's happening in the room,
yes,
is more aligned with the self-disclosure that can be helpful. And I think for some therapists, they think that if they talk about anything of their own experience, they think they're doing a bad thing. When really, if it is, like you said, done skillfully in a way that's relational, I think can actually move things forward, especially around talking about race.
Yeah, I think that's so right. So are you open to doing a little bit of a pivot? Because there's something that I've been wanting to ask you about.
Let's do it.
I'm curious to hear your experience coming out as a gay man. And have you been in North Carolina for a long time?
Yeah, so my I'm actually a military brat, and we lived in the Netherlands before this.
Oh.
And before that, we lived in Italy. So it was a complete and utter culture shock.
Yeah,
moving to Hope Mills, North Carolina. I had never, I was socialized very differently and have a very different lived experience. I'm actually a dual citizen of Great Britain and America.
Wow.
Both of my parents have Jamaican heritage. Dad met mom in England. And after dad's family immigrated from Jamaica to Florida, and my dad met my mom in England. And so that's my little bit of story there. And so, you know, I actually came out in the context of a predominantly white Catholic church retreat setting. And yeah, I've been going to this retreat called Search, which is like Search for Christian Maturity. And one of the things that the youth that have gone through it the first time, they would come back and write a talk about who they are and what their relationship with God is. And so I came out in that context. Looking back now, I'm like, wow, the prefrontal cortex definitely wasn't developed because what? You did what? Yeah, it was like a big deal. I had to get approved from the bishop, and I'm not currently a practicing Catholic. So, but I came out in that context, and I don't know, something told me it was time and I needed to. And
how old were you?
16, 17, I
okay.
think. Yeah. So developmentally, it makes sense, right? Especially yeah. for that cohort of LGBTQ people at the time. Yeah, it's like, for me, I felt like in order to survive, I had to claim more of me. And I remember I wrote my talk. I couldn't read it out loud. And the way it works is you write it by yourself and then you read it in front of other youth, and then the youth committee then decides who should go forward. And mine was about faith and me being gay. And so I had to give it to a friend to read it for me. And I just remember how cathartic it was to do it the first time. I just cried when I wrote it out, and then I gave it to him. He said it. And in order to come out to my mom, I had the talk in my hand, and I was about to hang out with friends, and I was like, Mom, could you read this? She was watching TV. I slapped it down and I was like, deuces, I'm out. You know, I didn't have a pocketbook, but if I did, I would have picked it up with my keys and went about my business.
And how was that experience for you?
Liberating, scared. Oh my gosh, I was so scared. I didn't ever feel as if I would be disowned, but I just didn't know how my mom would handle it. I mean, being Catholic at that time, you're sort of taught, well, being gay is not the problem. It's acting out on being gay.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of theme came up again. But we navigated it. You know, we stayed in it. We didn't talk about it much. I kind of just kept living my life. I think going to college was definitely a safe haven for me and a place to hear my own voice and to experience the world and what it meant to be a gay Black man elsewhere outside of my family. It was definitely a differentiating time for me.
Got it. Yeah. I was just curious about it because I know there's still a lot of, you know, within the Black community, there's still a lot of like additional stigma that's present, that's thankfully changing. I was just interested if that was an additional hurdle that you felt that you had to overcome.
I think I had a little bit of a different experience compared to a lot of Black people that live in America. I mean, I definitely have worked with clients that have to navigate, and part of my research is sort of thinking about this navigation of what does it mean to be in sort of the dominant gay culture where being Black, being a person of color is something that is ostracized and diminished? And what does it mean to be in a Black culture in which there's ideas of toxic masculinity and being gay is a hindrance? And what does it mean to be thrust in the middle of that intersection and how hard it is? So I've been in experiences where I felt like I have been with a lot of Black people and I have to hide my gayness. It is something that I even now I kind of navigate it. When I present to groups, it's like sort of testing how able are they to hear a more intersectional conversation as to what it means to be a sexual and gender minority in the Black community? And, you know, Iris, I've been thinking recently, one of the difficult things about my work is that not only do I have to be an expert of what it means to be Black in America, in other ways, I also have to be an expert of what it means to be a sexual and gender minority in America, and the nuances of that even.
Yeah, that is a heavy load to bear, I would imagine, to speak for, to speak on behalf of these communities.
Well, sure. And it's like, and then the question is that my overcompensation, trying to be Wonder Boy, ways of showing up in the world? Because ultimately, really and truly, I can only speak for me.
Yeah.
And only for me at that time and in that moment. Because, you know, Iris, one of the things I loved about you, and I'm sorry, I know you had something you wanted to say, is I loved when we had our exchange that you said to me, and this was so graceful and so heartwarming and opening for me, Hayden, if you say anything that you disagree with on this podcast and you want to clear up later, I want you to know that you can come back and you can clarify.
Yeah, that's so important to me because I'm learning all the time. I know for a fact that I've said things on my own podcast that I don't agree with anymore. And I've said things in other interviews that I don't agree with anymore. And we're evolving all the time. I mean, hopefully, and hopefully, you know, learning. And so it's normal for opinions to change. And I think that pressure to like, say something that's right for all time, forever, and that we're going to think this way forever. That's a lot of pressure. And so I wanted to relieve you of that. And I have to relieve myself of that too, all the time. And I hope that we'll both look back on this and think, wow, you know, this is something new that I've learned since I said that. And that'll be a happy thing.
Well, and think about how value aligned that is in, you know, cultural humility and curiosity to be able to discover something not just new about the world, but something new about ourselves. Like, oh, my experience of that has shifted. That means to me that we would be showing up.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, showing up, not needing to be perfect and just trying to be as real and honest as possible. I mean, that's what I'm hoping for with this. And I feel like you've definitely shown up this way. And this actually is kind of a perfect segue into the last thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is your permission slips.
Oh my gosh, permission slip practice. So this came out of Brené Brown's work of Rising Strong. And one of the integrative practices was writing a permission slip to oneself. So in 2018, I did 100 days of permission slips to myself, and I put them on Instagram. And so many of my friends and family would comment about how much they loved it and how much one permission slip would resonate with them each and every day. And so right when George Floyd and Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper and Breonna Taylor and sort of the Black trans lives were lost all in that cluster, I wrote a permission slip to myself to really channel my anger. You know, when there's a lot of messages of what it means to be a Black man with anger, and to channel my anger to bring back my humanity and to set boundaries around, no, I'm not going to allow you to define me that way. And that's what one of the things that I think mustered my courage to write an invitation to white therapists. So then I kind of really was like much more awakened to permission slips. And so I encourage people to start their own permission slip practice, especially during these really questioning of meaning of who we are and who society is. We have to bring back some agency and some autonomy back to ourselves. And I think permission slips is one way to do that. So it is a practice of mine. Sometimes I share them and sometimes I don't, and to myself, just so I can sort of bolster whatever might need to be sort of shored up within myself.
I love that so much. And you touched on something that I just don't want to not address, because I think it's so critical right now, is this idea of Black anger and being labeled. And it's something that, you know, I just want white listeners to be aware of this, that, like, who wouldn't be angry? It's human to be angry. It's healthy to be angry. It's not healthy to shove anger down. It's not healthy to, you know, pretend to be happy all the time. And so anger gets such a bad rap, and it's something that I'm really passionate about changing, because I think if we're disconnected from our energy, we're disconnected from our life force. Like, anger is this very powerful, transformative emotion. And that's not to say, like, you have to go act out and destroy everything when you're angry, but that's energy. It's valuable energy.
What did you say? You said, if I'm disconnected from my energy, I'm disconnected from my life force.
Yeah.
That's ministry right there, Miss. No, seriously, really is. It absolutely is. And, you know, again, I would encourage your audience. That means they need to look at if they want to hold Black rage and Black anger in session, that means they also have to hold their own.
That's an invitation to hold your own. Thank you. Yes. And it's going to bring an energetic charge within you. And you've got to learn how to sit with that.
Say it again.
Got to learn how to sit with that energetic charge. It is so important. And I think it's one of the most valuable energies there is. Most of the work I do comes from anger with the way things are. But you can make it something beautiful. It doesn't have to always look angry. But it's also appropriate sometimes to just be in your rage.
Well, yeah. And of course, you know, like you said, it's the feelings are fine. The behaviors that go along with it, that's what needs to be watched. But I would be remiss if I didn't say this, Iris. I want to validate for everyone that's listening and to myself, to go into the vulnerability of anger is really, really scary, especially when you were taught that there's no space for it in your household, or society says it's not okay for you to be angry about things. I know when going towards my anger can feel like literally like I am going to jump off a cliff.
Yeah.
I think it takes strong relationships that are able to hold that, as well as your own self-compassion practice around your anger. And it is scary. And yet it is so very vital to get in contact with that life force that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so, I appreciate that. It is so hard to sit with most of us. It's like every culture has their own sort of way of dealing with anger, but generally it's like, okay, let's put a lid on it. And so it's very difficult to learn to connect with that. And it can feel like dissolving. It's sort of that free fall again. And it does take practice. And, you know, we talked about titration, like going slowly. I think that is helpful as well, so we don't overwhelm ourselves. But, you know, dipping a toe into the rage and feeling that energy can be quite powerful.
Sure. And just because it's uncomfortable doesn't mean it's unsafe.
Yes. Thank you. That is brilliant.
I can say it again. Just kidding.
Yeah. We're putting that one on Instagram. That's a good one.
Hey.
Well, thank you. This has been such a pleasure. I feel like there were so many times where it's like almost brain overload of questions that I want to ask. And so I think that means we're just going to have to do this again.
Oh, absolutely. We have to titrate this.
Yes, exactly. Oh my God. All right. Well, this was such a treat for me. Thank you again. And I think just to end, if there's anything that's just on your heart that you want to share with our listeners to close, we would love to hear it.
Yeah, I just want to thank everyone for spending the time and listening to this podcast. And thank you so much for the work that you're trying to do in the world. Your work is important. I see how important it is. Even though as I'm calling us all to do better, that doesn't mean that I don't see how hard and how much you're trying to juggle. So I really just want to extend some gratitude to all of us. There's a lot of suffering right now. We're doing the best we can, and I truly and earnestly mean that. Iris, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate your presence online and so much that you say that I completely align with. So thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.